Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. During the Press Club's renovation, these programs will originate from Omaha's historic Joslyn Castle. Today's speakers will be Nano Little, Joslyn Castle Director, and Betty Davis, Executive Director of the Douglas County Historical Society. The title of their presentation will be Hysterical, Historical, Sometimes Naughty, Sometimes Nice Stories of Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 17, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Dale Munson, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
It's no surprise that today's forum topic is this unique and picturesque building. And because we have two presenters and a tour of this place, we will dispense with our normal request for written questions to our speakers. And literally first up, as she mounts the podium, we'd like you to give a welcome to the executive director of Joslyn Castle with a little background, Nano Little. Nano?
Thank you all for being here. We welcome you. We are thrilled to have the Press Club here with us. They will be here from April 1st until the end of July, so please come back for lunch. Our board president is here also, and I want to introduce her, but she joins me in welcoming the Press Club. And then one of our best docents, Judy Alderman, is here. So, Mary Ann, do you want to stand up? Mary Ann Ramji, current president of the Joslyn Castle Trust. And Judy's over on this side. So I don't know what Betty plans to say, so I will start the story, and Betty can pick up from whatever I don't fill in. I will tell you a little bit about George and Sarah Joslyn, and then a little bit about how they came to purchase this property and go through the process of building what they built here back in 1903 when the house was finally constructed. George and Sarah are both from the East Coast. They were married there, left shortly after their marriage, and went to Montreal. George worked there for a short time. They did have a child of their own. They had a son who lived only 3 months. So for some reason, they got on the train and left Montreal and went to Des Moines. We think it probably had a lot to do with the loss of their only child, but don't know that for sure. They went from Montreal to Des Moines, Iowa, got off the train. There was a sign on a business there that said, help wanted, or whatever you said in those days. George went in, got a job. It was a newspaper business. He worked his way up very rapidly. He was very bright, very good at what he did. He did so well with that company that they said to him, go to Omaha and open our office there. The rest is pretty much history. George came to Omaha. When they first got here, they owned a couple of hotels downtown. Sarah was very involved in the management of the hotels. That and a number of other things that you will learn along the way about Sarah, they certainly lead me to think Sarah was every good at business as George was. She was very shrewd, very astute, and for many years managed this fortune on her own. George opened what was to become the Western Newspaper Union. At the time of his death, and he died at a normal age for then, but 1916, so he didn't live terribly long, was in his 60s. At the time of his death, he was the wealthiest man in Nebraska, had a fortune somewhere between $8 and $10 million. The Western Newspaper Union had 35 offices across this country. He developed it by creating a process known as ReadyPrint, which meant that he printed part of the newspaper in a central location and then sent it to the smaller town newspapers all across the country eventually. The importance of his business rests mainly with the fact that as people were moving particularly west but were settling in all different locations around the country, George's newspapers were keeping them informed, thus keeping them eligible to vote because they knew what was going on in the country. So they were getting information almost no matter where they lived, partially because of George's the importance of his business. After George and Sarah were both great horse people, and there is a photo of them up in the library on two of their best horses. They used to ride a lot, and they rode out this way, and they happened to fall in love with this particular piece of property. It was farmland. It was on the far western edge of the city. It has very interesting contours. It's not just a flat block of land. And, of course, it was lush and green. And so they approached the farmer and said to him, would you consider selling us the farm? The farmer did. We know that they paid about $32,000 for 5.5 acres, which is what they purchased originally, what we still have. In the process, they traded homes with the farmer. George and Sarah came to live in the farmer's house. He took his family and went lived in their home in North Omaha. George and Sarah lived on this property almost 10 full years before the house was fully ready to live in. First structure they built was a gatekeeper's house, which is no longer here. If you came in on that east drive, over the terrible bumps and chuck holes, which the state is promising to fix as soon as the weather changes, the gatekeeper's house was down in that area. There used to be also, while we're talking about structures that aren't here, they had a fabulous greenhouse, palm house, which sat just out here behind the main house, off the kitchen door. That's no longer there, and the gatekeeper's house is gone. What is still here is the carriage house, which is fabulous. That housed their carriages, later their cars, and on the east side of that, their horses. The last structure that was built was the house. They hired John McDonald, who became a lifelong friend and worked with them on every property that they were to construct, including, of course, the Josselyn Art Museum. John McDonald was one of the most prominent architects in Omaha at the time, drew their plans for them. They knew they wanted a Scottish baronial-style home. That is what this is. They paid $250,000 for the house. It was constructed in about 11 months, and it has about 20,000 square feet and 35 rooms. One of the most fun things, and we'll tour you through everything except for the basement, which is at the moment just a basement, but the rest of it you can see. George had in the basement, which was totally his territory, he had a billiard room, a card room, a smoking room, a wine cellar, an exercise room, two bowling alleys, and a walk-in vault. So they must have had a laundry room somewhere, whatever else they did down there, it was mostly George's. And I'm sure that Betty will want to tell you some of the funny stories that come from that kind of thing. Most of them aren't true, but they're very funny. I don't know, how much more do you want me to tell? That's pretty much the history of the house. The history of George and Sarah, the history of the house. We hope you'll stay afterwards long enough to walk through it with us, because we'd love to show you what's going on. I work with the Josselyn Castle Trust. We took the management of the property, which will keep you awake at night if you let it, but we have full management responsibility for both the house and the grounds, and we are the ones that have been doing for many years the restoration and the preservation. So just very quickly, and if you can walk through, we'll show you. We have a new tin roof on the front porch, which is going to be painted, but it's so brand new that it's bright and shiny. That's not its final stage. But there is one there, and there is also one over on the porte cochere side. There is a brand new door, which we put in the porte cochere entrance. OPS closed it when they were here, and we just reopened it. We're redoing the tile, putting a new ceiling over there, and we do have the original light fixture that goes over there. Every place in the front entry hall that is painted green is going to very shortly have a replica of the original wallpaper. We have a sample of it, which will knock your socks off. It is spectacular. I don't know. What else do we have? We just finished the ballroom on the third floor. which we're being very selfish about. We're not letting anybody use it, but we'll let you look at it. It is absolutely more gorgeous than we had anticipated it would be.
And the room we're in, did you address this?
The room we're in?
Yes. Did you talk about this room?
No, not really. I don't know if Betty's talking about it, are you?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. This is George and Sarah's music room. I think I'm taking more than my share of the time. This is not original to the house. And as you can tell, it's a very different style. This is a prairie style, where the rest is in the Scottish baronial mode. They added this about 3 years after they were here. This has original fixtures, beautiful stained glass windows, and this room housed an Aeolian organ, which sat over on this side of this little balcony. These enclosures are where the pipes were encased. There, and then under this little balcony on the steps. Now, I'll tell you one story, and I know this is a story, which Betty may not know. This fabulous stained glass window up here, I don't know if everybody can see it, was supposedly a surprise gift from George to Sarah on the completion of the music room. Now, the story goes, and there may be no truth to this at all, but it's a very fun story. After they were here, George wanted to build a music room. Sarah wasn't so keen on the idea, so she resisted a bit. Obviously, George prevailed. Now, if I had been Sarah and I'd been living on this property for 10 years, I finally get in my house. 2 years, 3 years later, George says, let's tear it up and add on. I think there may be some truth to that, and if it's that, I would sympathize with Sarah a bit on that. She might have just wanted to use her house. Anyway, the music room was added. It's a fabulous feature, and that is supposed to have been a gift from George to her. And that does mimic a bit what you might have seen on this side of the grounds if it were still a window. So can I answer anything quickly, or can you stay afterwards so we can walk you around? And
thank you, Nano. Thank you very much, Nano Little. And please do stay for the tour. Nano will be conducting that, and it'll be most interesting. As you continue to enjoy your lunch now, a touch of Omaha history, in fact, hysterical, historical, sometimes naughty, sometimes nice stories of Omaha. Anybody see any spelling error on that sheet that was passed out? Yes, I misspelled hysterical, I'm sorry. I did, yes. The teller of these stories is not necessarily naughty, but she is mighty nice, the executive director of Douglas County Historical Society, Betty Davis. Betty?
Well, I'm pleased to be here. However, this setting is marvelous with flags. I feel that I should boom out my fellow Americans or something, as opposed to just a story about Omaha history. My mission here, and this was, I was asked really originally, by Christine, who's familiar with our talks. I give a lot of step-on guide services for incoming motor coach tours. And as a result, I occasionally, whenever I have a say in where to recommend, I encourage them to go to the Omaha Press Club, because after a two-hour or an hour-and-a-half tour on the streets, it's marvelous to look at that view and see just what they've seen or what they might see following lunch. It doesn't happen very often. Incoming tour buses generally are already scheduled, but it does happen. And as a result, I was asked to talk about Omaha history. And it seemed most appropriate that since we're at Joslin Castle, that Joslin should tell the story of the Joslin family. And they did, and thank you, Nano. And my job now is to tell you the kind of community that they came to. Now, what you'd like to know, at least what I'd like you to know, is that the Missouri River was known as long as four centuries ago because of its position and primarily because of fur traders. They came over for plentiful beaver along the riverbanks. We were not yet Omaha by a long cry, but we were the Missouri River, and we had beaver. And as a result, all of the gentry of Europe wanted a fine beaver hat. So Omaha was a global priority way back then. The fur trappers had one unusual thing about them, as I was concerned. They would not allow any of their employees to know how to swim. They were afraid they might jump ship. Now, I don't know where they had jumped to, because it was total wilderness. They only went as far north as the Mandan Indian villages in the Dakotas, And it wasn't until 1804, when Lewis and Clark came through, that they encamped there their first winter, and then they went beyond. When they came through here on July 27th, William Clark came ashore, and it's marked by a landing place, Lewis and Clark Landing, right down by Rick's Cafe Boatyard. He came ashore because this was a high plateau at that time. And here were mounds of earth and soil that he eventually assumed would be remnants of an Oto Indian village. That evening, they went on upstream as far as what is now, of course, Epley Airfield. That's where they encamped. And then the next night, they encamped at N.P. Dodge Park. Those are all maybe 7 river miles or so, but that's typical. Have you ever wondered why on land you have small communities about 9 miles apart? Well, that was the evening lodging. That's as far as a buggy would get you or a horse. And that was the same problem they had in going upstream. When Lewis and Clark came back through here in 1806, it was downstream, a faster pace, and they didn't even stop. They went straight through. They were on the way home. But nonetheless, they left an important mark here. It would be 50 years later before the community of Omaha would be known. And a preview to that, where there were several gold seekers, adventure seekers that would go through here, not allowed to stay on the western banks beyond the Missouri River because of rules, and until the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed on May 30th, 1854, signed by President Franklin Pierce, only then could they occupy this land. Now, there were two exceptions to that. Bill Brown came through in 1850 seeking gold, decided his real gold was here. They needed a ferry boat. So for 4 years and a little longer, he had a ferry boat that graduated in size until it could actually take herds of cattle, and it could even take wagons. And across he came, actually allowed to come over in 1853 and stake out a town site of 232 city square blocks. He did that because the Indians permitted it, primarily because he had, let us say, plied them with Kickapoo joy juice on occasion, or given them free passage. They were his friends. But earlier, in 1846, when the Mormons came through, they were allowed by the Indians to stay in the area that we now know as Florence. It was a very treacherous winter. Many died, and had they not been befriended by the Indians, many more would have died than did. We, of course, have the Mormon Trail Center that marks that historic occasion. There was a narrow time range where they could leave the Omaha area and head west safely over the mountains. They sometimes didn't match that, and there were disasters across the roads and the ways en route to Salt Lake and what would become Salt Lake City. Well, nonetheless, Omaha, by 1854, in the history books, when it was established, was described as being inhabited mostly by wolves. This was not the two-legged variety. This was the four-legged. In 1854, they had to have a survey before they could establish, their homesteads. And they did that. Finally, the survey was completed by A.D. Jones. He also was the first postmaster. And on July 4th, they celebrated the completion of the survey, and several wagons came across, headed for the highest point of the plateau. And the land that now became Omaha was on a high plateau. The highest point was what we now know as Capitol Hill. We have it, of course, the building there is Central High School. And the reason it's called Capitol Hill is because we were presumptuous enough to think that we might be the state capital. We did manage to become the territorial capital by kind of an underhanded method overnight. And that kind of enraged the communities that were already established along the southern points of the river. Plattsmouth, Bellevue, they were quite anxious to be a part of this territory, the Nebraska Territory, and be named this territorial capital. However, Omaha obtained the title, and they built the first two-story brick building in about January of the following year. It's positioned about where the flags are to the Conagra campus. Later, right next door on that corner, would be the Budweiser Beer Garden. A lot of good Germans, a lot of beer. And at one time, we had as many as 27 Danish dairies. It was before regulations, huge number. And if you think about it, those immigrants coming over would find this farmland very similar to their countries. Later we would surge, but in the meantime, the first residents were Rachel and William Snowden. Now, I'd mentioned that on July 4th, they had their wagons come across on Bill Brown's ferry. People from Council Bluffs, Canesville, and among them were the ancestors of Bruce Lauritsen. And the bank celebrated its 150th anniversary last year. They were Wildcat Bank in those earliest days, established by the Kuntz and the Creighton families. And many of the founding families have descendants who still reside in Omaha. Property from the Kuntz family later would be purchased and established Fort Omaha. It was first called Sherman Barracks. There's a kind of not a true rumor, but a story that General Sherman didn't consider that large enough to bear his name. And it was changed then to Omaha Barracks. And later, when it was named headquarters for the Department of the Platte, they changed it to Fort Omaha. That was a very prestigious thing to have done, because this was a department connected with the Indian Wars, and it stretched from Canada to Arizona and from the Missouri River all to Montana. Well, in the meantime, Rachel and Billy Snowden came across. They established a log cabin, and those early settlers oftentimes would reside in the banks of the plateau or of the plateau drop-off. They would dig caves and live in the cave for just the day or two that it took them to erect a log cabin. Rachel Snowden was a good, upstanding woman. She brought a Methodist minister over from Council Bluffs, and that began the first church service held in Omaha. It's located, by the way, I should tell you, on the corner of 12th and Jackson. And it's marked now, it says Fairmont Creamery. It's now an antique store. Uncle Billy, or Willie as they called him, was known to drink a lot, but Rachel was a fine businesswoman, and she established the first hotel. So when you have guests that come to Omaha, you might tell them that the first hotel was called the St. Nicholas, and for a few pennies a night, Rachel would give you a blanket and the privilege of rolling up on the dirt floor in this one-room cabin right next to your neighbor. So you can see we have advanced a great deal. In fact, tonight is the formal dedication of the newest hotel in Omaha, the Hampton and the Homewood Suites, and that's in what we call the NoDo area. Nobody likes that name. That's a short for North Downtown. But that's a kind of a resurgence of what really started on the river. Because you see, Bill Brown's ferry boat, we had a sleuth track it down during Omaha's 150th, and he determined that the ferry boat would have landed in what is now the wildflower field just north and west of the parking lots at, Gallup University. We know Gallup for its polls, but the world knows Gallup because they send executives in from all over the world because of their mission and teaching, which is the finest investment that a company can make is in its employee. That's the finest investment there is. And they send persons from all over to be trained in that. Well, as Omaha developed right along the river, it took us 150 years to see that wisdom, but we finally have returned to the river now and are building. But in the meantime, A.D. Jones, after he did his survey, was named postmaster. Now, it's very important for you to know what the name Omaha means in the Indian language. Tightly translated, it means upstream people. But a little looser translation that I think shows what we are is above all others on a stream. And as you look to the way we have solved problems, we truly are above all others. A.D. Jones, in being named postmaster, no building, he didn't let that stop him. He simply carried the mail in his top hat, and he would tip his hat and give people the mail whenever he saw them. A bit later, when he had a building but might be too busy to really have put the mail in the right slots, he didn't let that worry him. He simply put the mail in a bushel basket at the entry and let people pick it up on their own. Soon there would be really need for paved streets, but in the meantime, it took 30 years to put any paved streets in. They put wooden planks for sidewalks, but it was still a pretty muddy hole. But we had as many as 4 to 7 steamboats come down the river or upriver delivering goods, and the people would go down to the docks and dance on the top deck as they were unloading their wares. And the townspeople were so anxious to get those things, they sometimes scarcely unloaded them, and they had carted them off right from the riverboat. In the meantime, the river or the railroad would be built. In 1859, President Lincoln would stand with General Dodge on the East Bank in Canesville, look out over the space, and say this Missouri River Basin would be the perfect eastern terminus for a transcontinental railroad. It was delayed until after the Civil War, but in the meantime, they did build, and one of the reasons the railroad, you may not realize it, from the bridge where it's located, the railroad really goes south and then west. That's because at the time they started the railway building, they weren't certain where that bridge might be. And there was still this threat from Bellevue and places south that wanted that attention. Well, I'm going to interrupt the railway story long enough to tell you they got that attention. Omaha, by the time it had had its first territorial capital, the first two-story brick building, they used it as a community hall and for education as well. But they had a trouble keeping a quorum because the legislators often were in the downtown taverns. So being above all others, they solved that problem. They built a very impressive, what they hoped would be a state house on the site of Capitol Hill. That's why it's called Capitol Hill. And that's where they placed a tavern or a bar in the basement of the territorial capital. Now you see how many problems you can solve in very unique ways. However, 12 years later in 1867, the voting power lay in Sarpy County. In this little tiny spot in the road about 50 miles southwest of town named Lancaster was selected. Later, they say that they renamed it Lincoln to appease the Republican vote. And that very likely is true. Now, in the meantime, these steep hills that were downtown as a result of the plateau were beginning to cause a problem for the horse-drawn streetcars and later those newfangled automobiles that nobody thought would stay around very long. So Omahans solved that by digging down their streets. I call it our first form of urban renewal. Sometimes they destroyed the buildings. Sometimes they moved them west, probably as far as 30th Street. By then, that was the western edge. Or in some cases, they moved them out, left them standing on a tall cone of earth, moved the building out to an attached scaffolding, and then remove the scaffolding piece by piece until the building settled down to its new location. I call that the tinker toy method. There is one building, though, that I want you to be sure to see, and that's St. Mary Magdalene's Church. And that's on the corner of 19th and Dodge. And as you go past on the Dodge Street side, be sure to look at the fire escape because it leads to a rather large and ornate entry. That's the original entry door, approximately two stories up. So four different times, late 1880s to 1920 about, Omaha did dig down its streets. They even built railway lines in to cart off the dirt. Now about 1908, 100 years ago, by this time there were three brothers named the Baysdorfer brothers, Otto, Gus, and Charles, inventors located in the no-do area kind of today. They flew a dirigible named the Comet over City Hall in 1908. They also developed the first automobile in Omaha, and they named it Otto for Otto, O-T-T-O, the Otto, A-U-T-O. And these were just some of the enterprising people. Early on, I mentioned how the banks were Wildcat banks, and First National claimed to be the safest bank in town, and that's because one of the Kuntz brothers slept outside right next to the vault every night. And if you go down to their little museum that they've established, you can see a huge padlock that they also kept on it. Early bankers would go west, get gold dust, bring it back under threat of being robbed. They solved that. They simply stitched the gold in their pants trousers. And so they had no evidence of carrying it. There are more stories about this. First National later at another time, about 1913, wanted to build another bank. They were moving west, as far west as 16th Street. And in so doing, they contacted John D. Creighton, who was the son of a lesser-known Creighton brother. There were several Creighton brothers and several Kuntz brothers. John D. and Ed Creighton are the most well-known that then established. Their widows were sisters, and they established Creighton University. But in the meantime, John D. Creighton was quite wise in real estate investments, very crafty, very honest, but I mean very, very, what can I say, astute at selecting prices and locations at the right time. They wanted him to help them select the right site for the new bank. He asked for 3 days. The first day, he stood all day on the corner of 16th and Harney. The second day, all day on the corner of 16th and Farnham. And the third day, he called the board of directors together and said, place your bank on 16th and Farnham. Very simple analysis. He had simply counted heads each day, and there was an established traffic pattern at 16th and Farnham, and take advantage of it. Now, I'm going to kind of time frame forward, because another story that to me shows so much ingenuity in planning is the people of Decatur, Nebraska, had to travel in the 1950s about 50 miles, almost 50 miles either north or south to be able to cross the Missouri River. And logically, if they wanted to go directly across, that was twice that distance, down and back again. So what did they do? They looked at their coffers. They didn't have quite enough money for the kind of bridge they wanted. So they analyzed the situation, and they managed to stretch their money to build the finest bridge ever. They simply built it on dry land, and then they diverted the river under it. Now, you see, there are so many ways to solve problems. Nobody said you had to build it across the river. They teamed with the Army Corps of Engineers, who wanted to rechannel the river anyway. So that worked out well for everyone. But our river, when you stand at the press club and look out, you can see the curvature of the Missouri River. When you're down there, you don't quite realize how much it truly curves. Part of that is caused by natural flooding that occurred in the 1880s and 1890s. And when the waters receded, they discovered there was a portion of Iowa left in Nebraska. That became Carter Lake. Carter Lake is fairly sizable. There was even a court case so that it could remain there as Iowa. As you drive down Abbott Drive, there is a small stretch that extends over Abbott Drive, which causes a lot of problems for cab drivers and other people who need licenses in each state. They were required to get them for more than one state, more than just Nebraska. But in the meantime, the railroad also had presented a bit of a problem. Now, we have the Barker collection of letters, and I must say that at the Douglas County Historical Society, we have the General Crookhouse Museum, which is a restored 1879 Frontier General's home. We also have the Library Archive Center, which has been designated the official archive for Douglas County. And in it, we have a number of collections that are priceless, from families, from businesses, and as the official archive, we're the resource then for all of your research for your families or for anything that you might like to write. History does repeat itself, so come in and find out. But nonetheless, in this collection, we have the Barker collection of letters. An immigrant, Joseph Barker, left behind here by his family who wanted to return to England, family health reasons. As a young man then, he was left to watch the properties, and he diligently wrote over 1,000 pages of letters between late 1860s and early 1870. And in that, whenever he referred daily to the bridge, the speculation is, where will the railway bridge be placed? The railway lines were one thing, but the bridge, capital B, whenever he wrote it, he was a terrible speller, by the way. There were no regulations at this time. It was very difficult to index the book that we finally published because one location might be referred to with many different spellings. But nonetheless, he referred to it as capital B for bridge, and that eventually, of course, was selected at this site, which made Omaha grow. And Ambrose, in his book, credits the railroad with the surge of growth in Omaha. But in reality, not only is that probably the most important thing that happened so far is growth. We must remember that we also have a strategic location on the river and then on the trails that all came through here, making the outfitting men, the hardware men, some of the wealthiest in the city, because people simply didn't outfit their wagon trains or their carriages until they came across the river. Otherwise, it was too heavy. But here we are with the bridge being established, and soon after that, and the railway being completed, that Omaha began, was the site chosen by the Union Pacific to build its headquarters building. Now, this enraged the people of Council Bluffs in Iowa because Abraham Lincoln, after all, had been on the banks of the hillsides over in Canesville, Iowa. And they sued the state, the city, and that eventually got into the Supreme Court, where Iowa did win. However, the Union Pacific continued to build its headquarters, clean, nice structure, impressive in downtown Omaha, and then they put their old, dirty old roundhouse over in Council Bluffs. So there you go. But nonetheless, what have we got here? We have a city who's very hospitable, who's kindly. Streetcars, when they came down Douglas, it's still steep. Can you imagine what it would have been before they dug the streets down? When they rounded the corner on 17th and turned right, oftentimes the trolley would become disengaged. Now, the clerks at Brandeis, right inside the Douglas Street entrance, knew the schedule, would watch, and if that happened, they would run out and put the trolley back on so that the motorman wouldn't have to get out of his seat. Isn't that nice? Now, I have another story. Bill Stock is president of Johnson Hardware. Johnson Hardware started out as F.A. Schneider, and that was Omaha's oldest existing firm. It was a hardware store, hardware company. And Bill Stock's great-grandfather was a motorman, a streetcar motorman between Omaha and Papillion. And in about 1920, when it was by far a wild space between those two locations, he would simply carry his shotgun with him as he was driving. Now, this was not to protect him. This was to shoot the wild rabbits that he found in his path. Then he would take them home and eat them at night. We're very thrifty. I had mentioned John D. Creighton and how astute he was with land. Erastus Benson bought from him 900 acres to establish Benson Place. And then Mr. Benson teamed with a very slick realtor named Mr. Maine, M-A-Y-N-E. In fact, their main street was at one time M-A-Y-N-E. He knew that being about 6 or 7 miles from downtown Omaha might be a problem to convince people to move to this new community. So Mr. Maine purchased the sleekest teams of horses, the nicest surreys possible, and then he drove at breakneck speed with his customers so they wouldn't realize how far they might have to go to reach downtown Omaha. Bensonites, and we have the Benson Historical Collection in our archives. In reading that, it's very interesting because Bensonites considered that Omaha's water may not be clean. And whenever they ventured into Omaha on any kind of a trip, they carried their own water. Isn't that interesting? Dundee, of course, was formed from the home of the estate, the large farm of the Patrick family. And one of the Patricks had married Joseph Barker, who had written the letters. One of their daughters was so lovely and beautiful and so vivacious that they called it Happy Hollow, and it still bears that name, Happy Hollow Boulevard. And for a time in 1907, they established Happy Hollow Country Club there, using the buildings of the Patrick family, the homes, as their original clubhouses. In about two decades, they moved west then, and then that became later Memorial Park as we know it. It was interesting that those two properties, Benson and Dundee, were subdivided from farmland. Usually homes are established in a grid pattern next to the railroad or to water bodies for supplies. Now, this grid pattern was shattered early on, though, because Harrison Johnson, who was one of the earliest settlers and who signed the city papers, He took a shortcut to his homestead southwest of town. And when he did that, his wagon ruts became so deep that they eventually just called it a county road. That's how Omahans were. They adjusted. Very soon, they paved it, and they named it St. Mary's Avenue, because by then there was a convent located along there. Now, I must summarize, but there's so much history. I want to tell you, you'd probably know that Omaha gave the world many things. Godfather's Pizza, and that's because, you know, Willie Thiessen had a bar in the southwest section of Omaha, and next door he noticed many of his customers go next door and get Mom and Pop's pizza, bring it over and drink with his beverages, probably beer. And as he did that, he eventually accommodated his customers by putting a doorway between the two spaces, and then later he bought them out, and that became Godfather's Pizza. Fellows playing cards at the Blackstone Hotel, including Mr. Kulikowski, who owned the Central Market, as well as the Schimmels, who owned the hotel. They didn't want to break into their game. They wanted to continue their game, so they developed the Reuben sandwich. They could play right through and still eat. Now, the tip-top curlers, those little curlers went all over the world. Tip Top was one of the first, in fact, the first apartment area built in the Nodo area, converted from the original Tip Top. Now, there's something else that Omaha has also given the world. There were two sisters, and at the time of our Trans-Mississippian International Exposition, which was held in 1898, brought here the idea by William Jennings Bryan, who had been in Chicago at the Chicago World's Fair, or Chicago Exposition, I should say, came back, very encouraged, and said that we could improve our economy. There was a Great Depression across the country in the 1890s, and we could improve our economy, giving our locals, employment to build this, and then attracting the tourist dollar if we had a similar exposition. And they did produce that, the Trans-Mississippian International Exposition of 1898 and National Indian Congress. Buffalo Bill came. They had 184 acres obtained from the Kuntz family. Nothing really remains today, but I do have some chunks in my own private collection of someone who was a building up there, because when they demolished that, they simply pushed the chalky chunks of buildings into the sewage. And when he found some chunky chalks of chalk, he knew that if they were carved, they had to have come from the Transmiss. They were not built to last, but they lasted one important year. It became another exposition the following year, done by different management, and eventually had to be sold because the marketing techniques of 1898 were overwhelmingly marvelous. And the next exposition didn't fly quite as well. They dismantled everything or sold it. And one of the things they dismantled was the log cabin, which was exhibited by Minnesota. Good marketing. Every state was represented in something. When they dismantled the log cabin, they labeled everything, shipped it down the river, roughly to about where the Bellevue Bridge is located now. They took it ashore on the Iowa side, and then they built an establishment out of those bricks, or out of those logs. And they built it on the county line between Pottawatomie County and the southern county next to it, Mills. Now, you might imagine what that was for. Omaha was rich in all these kinds of homes. This was a gambling establishment. And when the authorities from one county would come, they simply moved to the opposite side. Very good problem solvers. But don't let me forget about those two ladies. Actually, they were soiled doves. They went to the Transmiss founders, requested that they be asked and permitted to establish, let's call it a house that was not a home, within the grounds. They were denied that, so they selected to go across the street. And legend has it that they attracted as many people to their body house, their house of ill repute, that the Transmiss did, and I doubt that. We brought in 2.5 million people in 5.5 months. But these two sisters practiced in Omaha, got their foundation, you might say, for 2 years, and then they went to Chicago. And it is documented that they were considered the finest madams in the nation. But you must be careful who your children marry. These two ladies were destined to do this. Their names, the Everlay sisters. So there could be no other choice. I mean, after all. Now, Omaha was extremely proper. I do want to emphasize that. And I just have to stop, but I have two more stories I must tell you, if you don't mind. The Tuesday Musical, which is just the finest musical group, I think, in Omaha, because you have marvelous stars. They're brought in by volunteers. They had their beginnings, and we have their collection as well, in the early 1890s. The very earliest performers, however, were members of this organization that was formed. Very prominent women within Omaha, but they did not want to have unjust approval. And so whenever they auditioned, they would rig up sheets and then audition before their members behind the sheet so they hoped they were not known. And that's how they had their earliest performers. Later, of course, they brought in national figures. Well, the Transmiss, the ladies of the YWCA, noticed that the statues surrounding this magnificent display of buildings and technology and just so many exciting things, the statues surrounding the walls sometimes were a little bit too graphic. So one night, under cover of darkness, they went down before the Transmiss opened, and they took their hatchets and their hammers, and let's say that they removed all protruding identifying parts. So Omaha, as you can see, has a real heart. They know how to solve a problem. They know how to be kindly. Just think of those Brandeis employees waiting for that trolley to go off. They had a wonderful future, and they simply adapted all of their lives. But there is one thing I do want to leave you with, and that's because the 130th anniversary will be celebrated next year by our historical society. And that's the trial of Standing Bear versus Crook. We call it the trial of Standing Bear, but in reality it was the trial of Crook. What it was is the Standing Bear, and of course all of the Indians were sent to reservations. They were not carefully selected. They were not accustomed oftentimes generally to the reservation area they went to. And Standing Bear lost many of his people. He was from the banks of the Niobrara, and when his son died, the son begged that the father would return his bones for burial on the banks of the Niobrara. They were in Oklahoma, and in late January, of 1879, Standing Bear with a band of 29 Indians left the reservation with the bones of his son. This violated the reservation rights, the federal rights. General Crook was at he was the commander of the Department of the Platte. He was ordered to arrest Standing Bear. Now, his sympathies lay with Standing Bear. And this, to me, is the answer to peace, and it's the answer to solving any problem. General Crook did not disobey his superior, even though his sympathy lay with the Indian. He arrested him, but at the same time, he put in motion a defense program. He obtained two lawyers who represented Standing Bear for no cost. He also engaged the support of Thomas Henry Tibbles, a newspaper reporter who ran from Fort Omaha at one time down into the Sunday evening Vesper services and encouraged the audiences to support the Indian. But most of all, he went to the Indian himself. And the Indian respected General Crook. That was uncommon for a military alliance in those days. He went to the Indian and suggested that he file a writ of habeas corpus against himself, the general. This allowed the case to go out of a hidden and very unknown military tribunal into district court, and it became a public issue. The result was a landmark trial. The Indian had eloquent words. The support of the people was the first evidence of support for an Indian in this area, and it became one of our earliest civil rights cases. The Indian was recognized with rights in the eyes of the law as a human being at that time, and it happened in Omaha. So Omaha is significant for many reasons, and we'll observe that in next year, the 130th anniversary. We may not have gotten the coin, and I will tell you what the coin really means in a private audience. Yes, it does have a hidden meaning to it. But we were in hopes the standing bear would be selected. But he is suggested for the first dollar coin. And so, after all, a dollar is four times the value of a quarter, right? So there we go. That's great. Anyway, I thank you. And if you have any questions, I'll stick around for a little while because I know Nano and you are all done with your lunches and I've talked and talked. But history just keeps rolling out. And Nano's available to take you on an escorted tour, and it's a lovely home. And we're very fortunate to have had these early visionaries that settled Omaha.
Thank you, Patty. Mm-hmm. So Betty suggests, and it's a great idea, Nano's ready, along with one of her assistants, to conduct a tour. But if you prefer to stay here and pop some questions to Betty, you could do that and then perhaps catch up with the tour later. We want to thank you very, very much for coming out today. I think it's been just a wonderful hour, and thank you so much, and thanks to the KIOS radio audience as well. Thank you so very much, and enjoy the tour.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Our guest speakers have been Betty Davis, Executive Director of the Douglas County Historical Society, and Nano Little, Joslyn Castle Director. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, April 17th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, May 15th, at the Joslyn Castle. The speaker will be Winnie Callahan, Executive Director of the Peter Kiewit Institute and Assistant Vice President of the University of Nebraska Foundation. Her topic will be the UNO Supercomputer. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.